Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Are you guys just singing it poorly, or do I just not know this song?
I'm singing it okay. Kessler, a little loose at the end there.
I think I have a different ending to that song in my head than the real one.
I don't even know what song that was. I was trying to sing along,
the Sanford and Son
theme song. Yeah, they sing it all the time in Scrubs as well.
Yeah, that's how I know it. It's like on my top two most stuck in your head songs of all time.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, guys, how's it going? Welcome to an episode of The Command Zone, your number one destination for all things Commander-related. Today, we have a special guest, but first, my name is Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
And we've got Alex Kessler.
The birthday
Kessler.
Boy.
Birthday,
and
hey.
Welcome back to The Command Zone. This is your guest host, Alex Kessler.
That's right. You guys may know Alex from The Masters of Modern. We shout him and Ben Bateman out every single episode at the end.
We shout you guys out every episode, kind of twice, because we do it like right before we talk about things, and then we do it at the end.
Wow.
So you guys only do it once.
Let me put it.
But we have twice as many episodes.
Oh, right.
Ooh,
true,
there
true,
you go.
True.
So
true.
We're equalized at this point, but we're falling behind rapidly.
Yeah.
If you didn't know, it was Alex's birthday recently. In fact, yesterday. Happy birthday, Mr. Kessler.
Thank you.
How does it feel?
I am now a year older and a year wiser. No, I don't know. I feel exactly the same.
Yeah, that's usually what happens.
Everyone's like, oh, man, you're that age where you start feeling super old. And I'm like, 28.
Oh. No, you got two more years.
So
no.
But like, even then, I feel like I'm so young at heart that I'm never going to have to worry about that problem.
True. You are a true child at heart.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you guys a story about turning 30, because I was once your age, and I remember thinking like, these 30-year-olds, they don't know. No.
Josh.
Like, it'll be fine.
Everyone
Mr. was
adult.
Like, yeah. And then you turn 30, and you realize, oh, this sucks. Just wait.
As
just wait, gentlemen.
That.
I'll come back to you in a couple years.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. We'll see how much it does suck.
Well,
I don't want to know if I want to get on a podcast about like the crippling anxiety of being in your 20s.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
In 2 years, if we're still doing the Command Cast, I will be very happy and impressed.
Me too.
I mean, I've
two
never...
more years. Two yeah. more years.
So it's not just your birthday.
Yeah,
but also
the Modern Pro Tour.
The Modern Pro Tour. So this must be like one of the great weeks of your existence.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, it's like magical Christmas. Star Wars is back. Modern Pro Tour is around.
It's
my
your
birthday. I really can't complain about anything happening.
You're on the Command Zone.
I'm on the Command Zone.
This is our birthday.
What's
gift
the
to
release?
You?
When? So we're recording this now.
This is Thursday
on the 4th,
the eve of the Modern Pro Tour. But when people are listening to it, it'll be Tuesday. The Pro Tour is over. So why don't you give us a recap of how the Pro Tour went?
So
yeah,
I mean,
oh,
it's crazy how well that one player did when he played that other guy in that spell. And then I'm really sad that PvD didn't make it all the way in there. The fact that Team Eureka had a pretty decent finish. Also, the Eldrazi deck.
That one crazy deck that
no one saw coming. Yeah. Like everyone thought Eldrazi was going to just be it. And then that one deck, all those cards were legal and Modern forever. No one found that deck before.
That crazy. Insanity. That guy can brew.
Yeah, no.
Turns out Bribery is a real card.
Make sure to listen to our episode where we at least tried to get the winner and or some of the top 8 players to guest on the podcast right now. They come out on the same day as this one. If you're listening to this one, you should listen to that one too.
If you had to make one big prediction going into the weekend.
Now that the weekend is over, Eldrazi Mimic is going to be the card that everyone's like, oh, right, that's a card, and it's insane because you get to play it for free off of Iavugan.
And what's the combo here? Is it just turning into a 4-4?
You turn 2 that, turn 3, play Reality Smasher, get in for 3, and then turn 4, lead Insanity.
Get in for 3?
No, you get in for 7
10.
Or 10.
2
because...
Reality Smasher.
No, no, not Reality Smasher, sorry. Mattery Shaper. So you play. So turn 0, you play... Iavugan, or turn 1, Iavugan into Mimic, then turn 2, you can play
Mattery Shaper. And then turn 4, you Reality Smash.
Reality Smasher, because that's when you can tap.
Seems Ugin good with that Mimic.
Yeah, no, it's insane. That deck, I'm super worried about it.
All right. That's good to know. Eldrazi, by the way, a fan favorite in EDH, and that's what we're here to talk about today.
Oh, Tron won't make the top 8.
I can agree with that. I think Tron's in a bad spot.
There won't
spot
be a
right
single
now.
Copy of Tron in the top 8.
Tron, I'm going to say Tron... It's looking okay to maybe, possibly, but maybe not make the top 8.
That was so vague. Your hedge in your
there
pants.
There is a chance.
That was my hedge in the beginning.
I don't know.
This is not the Modern Zone. I don't know much about Modern.
The Modern Zone.
There was a moment where the Masters of Modern podcast was going to be the Modern Zone. when I thought like the zone was going to be the branded.
We actually, I remember talking about that. Yeah. And I was like, we don't have to be that tied together. You guys could have like a name that, you know, is cooler. Now you're Masters.
Yeah.
Otherwise you would have been Zoners.
Yeah. You guys are like, I imagine you as the characters of the show. What's the show where they traveled through portals a lot?
The video game
Sliders.
Portal?
Sliders. Which is a callback. And we're more on the like, we're on a mountaintop and like,
you guys are
monastery
monks
yeah, that are like people come to with questions.
Yeah, that's like the it's like you climb the mountain and you get to the monk, but you can ask any question in the world and the monk will answer it, but he can only answer it with one word.
Yeah,
ooh,
yeah.
Deep.
So we're like the Jeskai. You guys are planeswalkers.
Okay, I'll take it. Speaking of Jeskai, we had a little bit of a snafu, a rule snafu.
Oh right. Where are you going with this?
Last episode, yeah. Well, because Narset is Jeskai and.
Okay.
So we were talking about
We
were talking about the card Preacher, which was one of Craig's pet cards, and we said incorrectly, we're redacting what we said, that Preacher gets around Hexproof. Now it's a little bit complicated because Preacher does still target a creature, and even though your opponent chooses the target, you're still in control of the effect. So Hexproof does stop the Preacher effect. So it doesn't work on Narset, which is why the Jeskai, awesome segue.
Yeah, the Preacher is still sweet, however.
Still a good card.
This card's still awesome. It's great art, straight out of an anime, unfortunately.
I'm sorry if you went out and bought a bunch of Preachers so that you could take care of the Narset so there are problems in your play group. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, instead just buy a
Wrath of God.
Yeah, that's good.
What's a
Flesh Preacher? Like, Preacher, if it worked on Narset, would just... I mean, they have to get the creature back before they can do anything.
True. And the best part is they would have to choose it. They would have to be the one that would be like, yes, you get my Narset.
But we don't want to have any cards out there that are really good against Narset, because then Narset wouldn't be quite so broken, right? So let's not... I'm not
Isn't spell. There like the Lantern? Can't you Lantern and then use Preacher to steal her?
Sure, but then there's two cards. It's way harder than one.
Yeah, but one's a land. Lands are free.
Just Fleshbag Marauder, guys. Yeah.
Speaking of pet cards of Alex Kessler...
Fleshbag Marauder.
Love Fleshbag.
That's my nickname for you. No, Alex.
I really don't want that.
I call him Fleshbag Kessler. Bless you.
Well, he's allergic to that nickname.
Clearly.
No bueno.
All right, let's move on to our main topic today, folks. It is improving your deck. It's something that we talk about a lot on the show, and we sort of nebulously talk about it, and we never really focus on what it means to improve a deck, specifically in the case of taking a deck from V1 to V2, if that makes sense. It's one of the most important parts about EDH. You can't just assemble a deck and just decide, all right, it's good forever, because you get to play it a few times. There's a lot of testing and stuff that needs to go into it. And Alex Kessler is here, and he's brought his Marin of Clan Nel'Toth. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah.
No, you have to say it like this. Marin of Marin. Clan Nel'Toth.
Toth. I'm okay with that. That's except okay. That. I mean, I'm really afraid now, because I prepared a whole podcast on awesome dance moves that you can do.
That's not a good podcast subject because you have to see it.
You can teach people through music.
So we're going to talk about how to improve your deck and sort of basically taking the leap from V1 to V2. And Kessler, you have done this with this deck, correct?
So there's an interesting story about where this deck came from that I realized once the subject matter was told, and this deck was the one we were going to play with it, and I can explain away.
Go for it.
Please do.
All right, so my first EDH deck was Teneb way back in... Time Spiral Block.
Teneb the Harvester,
which is a green, black, white reanimator deck that dredged a lot and put a lot of cards in their graveyard.
These are sort of like the Elder Dragons 2.0. Between him and Intet and guys.
But they did the allied ones in a set that I didn't play for, and then they did those during Time Spiral to kind of show the mirror image, blah, 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 blah. But that deck has existed forever, and then I had Nath, which was a deck that was really unfun for everyone, because Nath's job was to make it so all of your cards weren't in your hand anymore, and then I slowly beat you by being a green-black grindy deck that did nothing while you had no cards in hand.
It's the most Kessler thing ever.
Kessler does love hand disruption.
And like doing a bunch of stuff that doesn't win.
Right.
All
right.
Yeah. Anyway, continue.
So I realized when Marin came out, I was like, oh, great, I don't have. I can change this deck. And I have, you guys might know this, but I have one of every of the two color pairs of decks. So Marin was my, Nath was my green-black one. And then I also had a weird green-black-white one that I've just had forever that I never took apart. And I kind of smushed them together.
Because you already had a lot of the pieces then.
Yeah, because Marin, like, Teneb was all about graveyard reanimator dredge to shenanigans. Nath was all about green-black value, sacrificey, get their stuff, and so the two decks kind of smush together into a very adorable Irish, apparently.
And it is
Commander
fitting.
Deck.
No, Scottish. Because if it's not Scottish, it's crap.
Well, it is nice because Marin is standing in front of a dragon-esque creature, so it is as though you put two creatures together, a dragon and a human.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
The world came together.
So this is probably something.
Nath is a elf, before anyone shoots me. Sorry.
He is an elf.
I was about
to
shoot
you. Elf warriors. So do we, I mean, how much do I, oh, because you guys have the video, so it, okay, I don't have to explain what Nath does.
Yeah, it's fine. If you know what Nath does, that's great. If you don't, it's not key to the story. This is probably a process that a lot of people are going through right now because the Commander product came out. A lot of us built decks. And then right around this amount of time is when I find myself with Mizzix, with Mazurek in the same spot where it's like, I played it a few times.
Yeah.
And so now I'm ready to make tweaks further from like what would be the version one of the deck.
Right.
And
version one for a lot of people is also just straight out of the box.
That's true.
Which is great.
That's true. Yeah. That totally counts, right? It's like whatever is the deck that you play with for a little while and then your brain starts going, well, that card's not any good. Or man, I wish the deck could do this and blah, blah, blah. And so the process of tweaking the deck so that version two is better and then version three maybe. And I don't know how far people go. I'm usually done around version three or four.
You don't just continuously tweak forever because I feel like I feel like maybe two versions, and then from that point on, it's always like I play one game. I'm like, oh, that card's way worse than I thought, or that card is way stronger. Are there redundancies that I can maybe throw in the deck?
Well, it's interesting because that's sort of our first question, right? Is how many games do you play with your deck before you start tweaking it? You know, do you feel like, oh, I've got a good feel and I can make some changes?
Well, I was going to say mathematically, it's an interesting question because with 99 cards and you're drawing, say, 20 to 30 of them in a game,
I would say 30 would be a lot.
Yeah, you're basically missing out on a fifth of your or 4/5 of your deck every single time you play it, unless you're able to add in the consistency like with tutoring and stuff. So, for me, you have to be able to at least see every card in the deck and then variations on how those cards work together.
Oh, see, I like. Game one after game one, I generally feel like, okay, these are the things. And some of that is with, especially with Marin and the new commander products, you don't know how those commanders will feel until you really crack it out of the box and see how it plays.
Yeah, because experience counters just never existed before. So.
Right. Like, I didn't realize how crucial or how insane it is to make sure that, because the first time I played it, I didn't have all of these like free sac effect creatures that you get value on immediately when playing her, and how much people are going to be like, oh, I need to kill Marin right now. Because if I don't, you'll get experience counters and those never go away. And so those are things you kind of have to get the first time you feel it, and then you can kind of build things into it. Often there are things that I just realize that I always, when I first build a deck, forget to add. So artifact hate and enchantment hate.
Yeah, that's so true.
Like, the first time I build a deck, I never put that in there. And then I like play a single game. I'm like, oh, right. You need a way to kill artifacts and enchantments.
I have to be able to deal with my opponent's stuff. I totally forgot that part.
Right. And I think the first thing I added was Caustic Caterpillar into the deck after the first time I played it, which is the Magic Oridon's 1/1 for one green that you can... that has literally is a sacrificable
destroy target artifact or enchantment. Yeah.
And just because you can recur it, he keeps coming back.
That's right, folks. You can play commons in your deck. They're often very good. Before we get too far, let's actually just read what Marin of Clan Nototh says. She is 2BG for a 3/4 legendary creature human shaman. Whenever another creature you control dies, you get an experience counter. Like we said before, you can't get rid of these. This is the new ability from Commanders in the Commander 2015 set. And at the beginning of your end step, choose target creature card in your graveyard. If that card's converted mana cost is less than or equal to the number of experience counters you have returned to the battlefield, otherwise, put it in your hand. So I feel like this is actually different with this deck because you just need to play Marin once and have a couple of experience counters to start understanding your deck a lot more, right?
Well, and this is also... So, like, green-black graveyard shenanigan decks cycle through so many cards and so much more than I think other decks. Because, like, correct, if you're playing, like, a blue-white or even a red-white or some other deck, you're only going to see 30 cards. In this one, you're dredging 6 cards a turn plus tutoring 3 times a turn plus...
Right,
this.
So you're getting a good look.
One game and you can already feel like, oh, I didn't have a tutor target for this situation where I need it, or I didn't have a win condition. You kind of get a feel for what cards you need with this deck. But, you know, I recently built a red-white deck, and that one has taken many playthroughs to figure out, oh, this needs... some way to gain card advantage. This needs some way to like get around these situations. Otherwise, it just doesn't do anything.
Yeah, I think it's totally deck specific. I do generally like to play at least a few times before. And I usually have like a good inkling after one time. These cards are probably bad, or, oh, I thought this effect was important and it may not be. But I'll usually play it a couple more times before I actually go through. Just because the process of pulling the deck apart and then rebuilding it is so big that I'd rather have like three or four pieces of information. You totally could do it after one though and make good changes. I just feel like that's going to mean I'm still going to have to do that again fairly soon.
It's tough too because you're going to have put pet cards in there as well as cute combos or things that you want to pull off but can't in that game. And it's going to be tough because sometimes you do have to get rid of your babies, as they say.
Well, after you've played a couple games is such a great point to do that mentally, right? Because when you're building the deck and you haven't played it yet, you're like, oh, if I get these three cards together, it's going to be awesome. I'm going to be able to do this cool thing. And then you play a game or two and you get your heart broken because you don't win those games. And then you're like, screw this crazy magical Christmas land thing. Just let me put in a couple cards that like kill all their artifacts.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, inherently, and this is something that you notice a lot in the Master Mod podcast, is I lean way more towards just good cards or good stuff. So like my first inclination when building a deck, because you always get to like, you put 200 cards on a table and you slowly get rid of them. And then I get to 120. I'm like, okay, what can I cut? And my first inclination at that point is just kill every card I love. Because those are the ones that are making, like, Vengevine shouldn't be in an EDH deck. As much as I love that card, in a green-black graveyard strategy, probably doesn't belong.
Right.
But, like, when you have Terastodon and the guy who has Undying that kills thing or Persist that destroys permanents, plus you have these three other permanent destroying things, you can cut it down to just the one, because eventually you don't need six of the same effect and you kind of just have to kill your babies.
That's really interesting, actually. And the next thing we have written down is, what kind of things are you looking for when you play the deck the first few times? So, you know, that's an interesting thing, is, and I mentioned it too, which is how much of any give, you know, you need like to fill certain categories,
right?
And then that's usually where I find a lot of the changes come, is like, oh, I thought I was really worried that like, oh, this category won't be filled, and so I put a ton in and it's like, I don't need that bad, or yeah. I definitely never want to have three of that or whatever.
Right.
It's interesting too, especially with the new Mulligan rules. If you're playing by it, this changes a little bit, because I think one of the things you need to look for with the new Mulligan rule is, can this deck function fine with the Vancouver Mulligan?
That's actually, that's a super good point. I think it's changed recently.
Yeah.
Like how you should build your deck. You really should have more lands than maybe you used to need. You probably should have more ramp than you used to need.
I think people need to cut high drops. I think
that
specifically the main thing that rule does is, you know, and I've noticed this because we play Highlander Roulette, which is this other 100-card format, and I almost directly ported my Geist deck to that. But my Geist deck has like 15 six drops, and that is not playable in that format. And it's the same thing now happening here, because before, when I opened a Hand of Seven, and I would just throw every six drop back.
Yep.
Because I'd be like, oh, they're going to go to the side. I'm not going to draw these six drops, so I'm going to have a higher chance of getting cards that I can play in the early game, and I'll get those eventually. Now that's not an option. So you really need to cut down on your higher curve pieces, or just play all the ramp and all the lands.
Yeah, this is EDH, man, and people want to play the big stuff. So I think that you got to just make sure your deck allows it in a world where you can't partial Paris. And that means
in a world. In a world.
Yeah, I think it's just not free anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It used to be a free roll to play as many Silver and Primordial-esque cards as possible, or all the Primordials, really.
Yeah.
And now it's not as much of a free roll, because you need to be able to cast those things.
Don't play Silver and Primordial, folks. Don't do it.
It's banned.
Yeah, it's banned.
So banned.
It is banned. Kessler, no wonder. Yeah, you better kill that baby. Get out of here, Silver and Primordial.
I killed it. It's gone. Same as Primeval Titan, also not Primeval. Yeah.
Primetime. No, oh, Primetime's definitely banned. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And Emrakul and Grizzlebrand. All these would be in this deck, the green-black. So many
all the banned green and black cards would be in the green and black deck. Yeah, of course. That's why they're banned.
Yeah. Well,
how many non-green and black cards have gone banned in the last?
Well,
what was the last? Oh,
Prophet of Kruphix.
No, well, it's green.
Oh, it's green.
Yeah.
Green's the strongest color in Commander. I'm going to say it here.
Right, blue now is, you heard clearly it here the strongest first color in Commander. But
I think
it
goes
second.
Actually, I think the real controversial statement is, I think green's actually the second best color in Magic, period.
Ooh,
blue is the best. I can't argue against that. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah. I think green's the second best. I think a lot of that has to do with Modern Magic and Wizards of the Coast's creature inherent.
Yes. There's been a concerted effort by Wizards over the last like 7-8 years, because they realized that the part of the game that sort of resonates and is the most fun is the creatures and the creature combat. And so what's the creature color? Green.
Right.
So what are we pushing now as a game?
Yep.
More creatures. Right. So that's just inherent.
And we've had ramp in standard forever, you know.
Yeah. But one, you had like Abrupt Decay and like all these other weird green things that are just like very, very, very strong. I think honestly that red and green have grown the most over the last 10 years, and black and white have been put in this weird
Well, blues definitely weakened from what it was.
It definitely is weakened, but like inherently blues things that are best at are get things that break the game of Magic. And green too, it just we're kind of learning that mana ramp is really good.
ramp, cheating stuff out and getting stuff out earlier than you're supposed to.
Really, I mean, it was, and part of that is also artifact. So one of the reasons I think green is the worst color in Battle for Zendikar is because other colors can ramp. And in early Magic, artifact ramp was everywhere. So green's one good ability wasn't good. But then when you ban every artifact ramp spell in the entire game out of every format, and green's the only color that can do it, you gain a lot of strength for that color.
Fortunately, in EDH, we do have lots of artifact ramp that everyone can use, which is very nice. Now, let's talk more about improving your deck. The third thing we have written down here is, how much do you take into account what your opponents are playing? Because I feel like this does make a huge difference when you start playing a deck. Because if you're just playing against decks that will hose yours no matter what, decks with lots of exile your graveyard abilities, someone that's playing Anafenza, it's going to be very hard to get a very good lock on what works and what doesn't in your deck.
True, and sometimes you'll run into commanders, like if Anafenza is on the table, I'm just going to not have a good game, and I'm going to be a sad panda.
Yeah, because it's a graveyard hate commander against a
graveyard
your deck.
Creature. Yeah, it's not even like I'm a blue-red graveyard-based deck, or I have a black-red artifact-based deck. No, it's creatures in my graveyard are the only thing that this deck can accomplish, and if those aren't there... I actually have a Teyza deck that if someone plays a Rest in Peace, it just doesn't win. I had to just insert a ton of enchantment hate that wasn't there originally, just because I knew if Rest in Peace ever got picked, I would just auto lose or played.
Yeah, that card definitely is very powerful. I don't think people give it enough credit.
Yeah, I think it's just something to watch out for, is you can have this bad taste in your mouth after a game or two, and you can think you need to change your deck a lot, and then you sort of realize like, well, it's really just that one deck.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and it's like, I don't want to make a ton of changes to my deck based on like there's one deck in my play group or one deck that person was playing that one day.
But sometimes you really want to, though. I mean, a very common impulse is like, gosh, that person hurt me so bad. I'm going to put this and this and this into this deck just so I can deal with that.
And then you play another game later and you're like, none of these cards do anything against these other decks because I don't have to worry about that stuff because somebody's not playing that thing. And I've definitely fallen into that category, and it's just something to watch out for.
Well, and sometimes it's metagame specific. For instance, you know, back in the day, I would only play with Craig and a few of our buddies at All-Star, and there's pretty much only four of us. And so, you know, one of our friends, Joel, which I think I mentioned last time I was on here,
yes, Joel,
would only play with land destruction.
Right.
Like Armageddon's everywhere.
Like a
and
smart
so
man.
I would edit my decks to be good against those things. Right. You know, but nowadays I play with you guys once in a while. I play with the Riot guys once in a while. I play at Heidi Ho, and that's like a 45-person league that is I never play against the same people. And because of that, I generally structure my decks to have as many answers to as many broad things as possible.
Right.
And maybe give them recurability more than I do of specific strategies that I need to be able to stop.
I think that's actually, in general, a good way to start with a deck. And then if you really need it to be meta-dependent, that's when you start making those cuts and figuring out, like, I need a Rest in Peace or I need Artifact Hate more than usual.
I mean, you got to build to your meta if you're in a really insular playgroup like the four people. And especially if, like, you'll be in these playgroups where everybody has a bunch of decks, but one guy, he only has two.
Right.
And if one of those decks is really good against your deck, then okay. You know, it just really depends on... the exact situation, but I would say in general, try not to overblow the amount of sort of, I don't know, the amount of weight that you put on any one deck that you're playing against when you're sort of playing one of your new decks early on.
Agreed.
And I think that's something also, the color philosophy really matters here. So like green-black, that's not as much of an issue because green-black are the two color pairs that really can answer anything between the two of them because green can answer anything but creatures. Black kills creatures. And then black and green have the most tutors of any color other than maybe white. But when you go into some of the other colors, knowing like, okay, red and white can't deal with this thing.
You're right.
Specifically drawing cards. They can't find the things they need. Or blue and black can't kill anything.
Right. Or black and red can't take care of enchantments.
Right. Yeah. So like knowing what your weaknesses are and making sure you're not walking into, you're not taking your only, you only have a black red deck and you're going to a room with only green, white enchantress decks. And you're just like, well, I'm never going to do anything.
That's never happened before. Like, just nobody had any follow-up. Okay.
That's what happens when three people are at the table sometimes. You just sit there and you're like, well, I said my thing. I thought Josh had something. I looked at you. I'm like, oh, it's a silence.
Wow, that's 96 episodes. It's never happened. Okay, so, well, let's move on and we'll talk. This is a subject we can definitely come back to. I think we just only touched on it here. But let's talk about the deck specifically about Marin. Because this is a really popular commander. I think it's the most popular right
now. It's actually risen in price as well, because I believe the ability here is incredibly strong.
I mean, the fact that you still draw the card,
yeah,
if you don't have as many experience counters as the one that you pick. So I don't want to read Marin all the way again, but just to refresh, at your end step, you look at how many experience counters you have. Then you choose a creature card in your graveyard. If its CMC is less than or equal to the amount of experience counters you have, you put it directly on the battlefield. If it's more than the amount of experience counters you have, you take it into your hand.
Which something key insane. About that, though, is that it can be higher.
True.
You have the choice.
Yes.
It's not choice. You have to reanimate a thing.
No, you get to choose.
If
yeah.
you want, you can be like, well, I just want to get my flash whatever creature back and just have it. You can.
Right. And I think it's that last part that really pushes Marin into the crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's still very useful early in the game when you don't have a lot of experience counters. You're still just getting advantage. You're just getting extra cards.
Yeah, and she'll draw right. you a card no matter what.
As even long if as you have a card in your graveyard, you get it back.
So let's talk about... Well, this is interesting. Like, when you started building the deck, you already talked about you had a couple of decks that were already had, like, their toe in the water, sort of what you thought Marin wanted to do. Was there anything when you took Marin that you were like, okay, this deck has to do this?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is kind of also the segue, but between the two subject matters.
It's Jeskai, Narset, what?
Yeah. So, generally, something I didn't realize was really important was low drop creatures that have sacrifice abilities on them. So a card that I've always put on my list of cards that I always like put in the pile of black decks and then always take out is Vampire Hexmage. And I didn't put it in the deck originally, and I realized the fact that you can just sac her, even if it's for minimal value, before once you play Marin is really good because you get the experience counters from it and rebuy it.
All right, let me read Vampire Hexmage. It's black for a 2/1 Vampire Shaman, has first strike, but the salient detail is sacrifice Vampire Hexmage : remove all counters from target permanent. So there's no cost associated with sacrificing the Vampire Hexmage. A lot of people play that card to just sort of axe out a Planeswalker or something somebody's invested a lot to put a bunch of counters on.
Yeah.
You're saying the important thing was actually that it can sacrifice itself for free.
Well, two sides. I do think actually the fact that it can be used as a removal spell or just some type of answer
destroy
to
target Planeswalker spell
is really important. I wouldn't just play a creature that just has the ability to sack it for no effect, or like you gain a life or something, and that card exists, or like do one damage to someone. That wouldn't be playable. But the fact that it has these inherent values that are important and can just be used if you need to play on turn two, and then when you play Marin, sack it so that you have one experience so you can get one of your one drops back or one of your two drops back if you can pull off enough.
Not to mention, Vampire Hexmage, I think, is a card that is severely underplayed. People are always playing stuff with counters on it,
right.
Even if it's a vivid land. I mean, you can really get someone that just doesn't expect... Because usually you play something with counters on it, and if it's a Planeswalker, it's like, well, someone has to attack it to get rid of these counters.
I mean, it helps, like, if someone's playing an effect creature, getting the -1 counters off your creature. If
right.
someone's, you know, I have Black Sun Zenith in the deck, so if I, like, get Mirren down to a 0/1 so I can wipe the board but save her, I can then bring Hexmage back to get her big again. You can use it to kill Planeswalkers. You can use it to kill every Hydra under the sun.
This is one of those cards that you always hear Magic players talk about, cards that don't cost a lot of mana, so you can play them early, but they can have some sort of good effect even if you play them late.
Yep.
You know, those are generally right. very good cards, which is like, well, yeah, it's a 2/1, so early it's fine, it does some stuff, but late it's not just completely worthless. And Vampire Hexmage falls in that category, although I got to say, every time I build a deck, it's in the pile, and then it never quite mates the deck. Because
true.
All those situations you talked about, they're still not amazing. Like, getting rid of counters on a vivid land, well, the land still taps for mana. It didn't do a lot. Killing a Planeswalker is great, but there's a lot of cards like Hero's Downfall just kills the Planeswalker. You don't have to cast a creature, then sacrifice it. You know. But in this deck specifically, you found the spot where I think Vampire Hexmage and the like, because Caustic Caterpillar is basically the same card, but it costs a little bit of mana and gets rid of something different.
Right. Well, it like what you're saying, this is a perfect storm. It synergizes with the deck, where Hero's Downfall would be actively bad because it's just a one-off spell that I'm never going to see
Marin
again.
Can't do anything Marin with Hero's Downfall.
Marin can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
It doesn't give her experience counter, kill a permanent, and is reanimatable.
Reanimatable, yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
I wish I could make up a word.
And Caustic Caterpillar is kind of the same deal. It costs a little bit more mana, but it's only one. The fact that it's only a CMC 1 means it can come back the turn that Marin normally can come into play.
Right.
And the fact that artifact enchantments are just everywhere. Like, Planeswalkers aren't nearly as ubiquitous as
Right. Let me read the card. Cost a caterpillar, 1 green for a 1/1 insect. You could pay 1 and a green, sacrifice the cost of caterpillar, destroy target artifact or enchantment. Yeah, you're right. So you sack this when Marin comes into play, if you have the mana. That will put an experience counter on Marin. Now Marin has 1 experience counter. You can choose cost of caterpillar from your graveyard. It has 1 CMC, so it comes right back onto the battlefield.
Right.
So that's pretty good synergy. Now, I wanted to circle back to something you said earlier, Kessler. When did you make the realization? Because you said that it took you a playthrough or maybe a game or two?
It took me 1 or 2, I want to say, playthroughs against real people to be like, oh, I need early game sac effects on attached to the creatures or mm-hmm. have a sacrifice thing, but that doesn't have the same engine that you kind of need.
So your brain was like, oh, it's hard to get the ball rolling, kind of.
Right. No, this is very snowball-y. It's really interesting how it works in that sense because at first, you're only getting these small value creatures, but then by the end of it, you're just like rebuying Terracidon and just blowing people's land up all day. And I kind of described it to people as it's kind of having Shieldred on suspend, where Shieldred costs 8 mana. So this is, you're getting it on turn 4, but you're only going to get dirtily things in the beginning or not do anything. But eventually, you're going to just be reanimating a thing every single turn. And, you know, because Fleshbag Marauder's in it, that also can make everyone sacrifice a creature if you want.
Shieldred is 7 mana, by the way.
Sure.
So powerful.
Get it right,
Kessler.
This is 4, which makes it better.
Yeah, is Shieldred in the deck, by the way?
No, I cut it because it was in the deck originally, and it was like another large drop that really was just super redundant and almost worse than...
I mean, by the time, I'm assuming, and I may be wrong, but by the time you get to enough experience counters that you're bringing back in a 7, 8, or 9 drop, you probably don't need 3 of them or 5 of them in the deck. You just need any one of those, right?
Right. And I have the tutor that gets the 1 green, the creature, it's a 1/1. I think it's an elf, 2 mm-hmm. colors and a green, search for a 6-drop.
Yeah.
I play that in every green deck.
And it also feels like the type of deck where Shieldred doesn't, this is going to sound weird, but she doesn't do anything when she comes into play, right?
Correct.
Whereas Terracidon comes in, has immediate effect. So if you can hear him rifling through cards, he's looking for something.
I'm getting all of the 6-drops because I think... Or bigger than 6-drop. And I think there's not that many. I think I'm almost done. But while we're talking about the last 1-drop that's really important to the deck is Spore Frog.
We've talked about this guy a lot.
Card. Yeah, one of my favorite cards. I'll read it. Spore Frog costs 1 green for a 1/1 frog. It says sacrifice Spore Frog. Prevent all combat damage that would be dealt this turn.
One of the few cards, by the way, from an old set like Prophecy, whose text is the exact same after being Oracle.
It's so simple and fantastic.
It's Fog Frog.
And cute.
It rhymes when you need it to. I would say I've tutored in this deck a lot because it's a lot of black tutor cards, and I don't think there's a card I've tutored for more than Spore Frog.
Interesting. The fact that, and again, like... Black is known for reanimation, for graveyard recursion, same with green. The fact that you can just guarantee that little Spore Frog's coming back into play, no less, with Marin out in the battlefield single time is very insane.
And it's better than Vampire Hexmage. We talked about good Vampire Hexmages, and it's just like better in almost every category because mm-hmm. it's 1 converted mana cost, it's still free to sack, it's vaguely removal spelly because you can protect yourself from the creatures, kind of removing them, and it can come back forever.
Pretty insane. Spore Frog, and we talk about fog effects a lot in the show as well, but fog effects in general, so powerful. Especially in this case, now there is a couple of Moments Peace, I believe, has buyback on it, or flashback. Has flashback, and people are...
Or buyback, sorry.
Yeah, people are in constant fear of a card that allows you to just fog again and again and again.
Well, they just won't attack you anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
As soon as you have that, they'll be like, well, I can attack you, and then I'll just lose all of the value from attacking you. Or I can attack Jimmy, who doesn't have fog on a stick, and the damage is going to matter.
Yep.
Yeah,
so,
it's sort of a truism about games and players of games. When they take action, they want to see some sort of effect from that action. Mm-hmm. So nobody wants to do something, even though if I attack into your frog, you have to use the frog and something did happen, but it feels like I didn't do anything. And people don't play games to not do stuff. They play games so that they can be like telling a story later and be like, yeah, and then I swung with my dragon and hit him for 12. They don't say so that I could, and then I swung with my dragon and then he Spore Frogged.
Well, and even better than, not better than the buyback spell, but the fact that Spore Frog is on the table and they see it.
Yeah.
They know it's coming.
It's like, oh, there's no, I have to kill that thing on someone else's turn so I can actually do anything against you.
I mean, that's the same thing with Moments Peace and Constant Miss, is that you cast it once, you buy it back, or you're able to flash it back everyone lives in constant fear of it.
Right.
And not even fear. Everyone just knows that they don't want to attack you because they just want, I want my stuff to
They're
do stuff.
Hoping you tap out so they can actually do something to you.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
It's even more sort of manipulative in a multiplayer game too, because you don't even think in your mind, well, I eventually have to deal with that thing. You can think, yeah, somebody else will deal with that thing.
Yeah. Interesting.
So after counting, there are a total of 7 anything over 5 mana.
Interesting.
Anything over 5?
Yeah.
Wow.
So most of the deck is 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 drops, and then there's these 7, 6, 7, 8 drops.
Oh, over 5. So 6 or
oh,
more.
Over 5. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I'm looking at Sadisi going,
No, there are 5 drops.
Okay,
there
gotcha.
Are quite a few of those.
Now, originally you had more then, so you had Shieldred and a few more, and that was one of the changes.
Yeah, yeah. The first thing I did was I realized that Mirren relies on a curve, and it's in her literal her card text. She cares about the curve of the cards you have in your graveyard because you'll be able to reanimate quicker, smaller things. And that was the first thing I noticed. It was like, based off of how quick I'm going through my deck, and I'm pretty good at dredging enough and making a deck that's good at putting cards in my graveyard, that you don't need that many 6 drops to start just getting really good value. And if you look at them, half of them are 2. Like, you know, I have Runescar Demon. I have all these cards that when they come in, you're going to either get the card you need or you're going to start winning.
Right. Runescar Demon tutors when it comes.
Yeah,
in,
it's demonic tutor on it.
Yeah.
On a creature.
Right.
So our next question we have down, we may have partially answered it. Well, I'll ask it. How did the deck play compared to how you envisioned it playing the first time? So, you know, that's something I try to keep in mind is like, when I build the deck, I have a certain idea of how I think it's going to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I play it, if it's not lining up to that, a lot of times I'm like, okay, I did something wrong. But sometimes I'm like, oh, I was just wrong about what I thought the deck should try and do. And actually the deck should try and do this other thing.
Right.
It's interesting, something that, and this is also just how the metagame has shifted around this mechanic of experience counters. When I first built it, people were so afraid of Mirren that, like, I built the deck being, so I need to cast it and then gain value immediately, and that's gone away. People aren't as like, oh man, I need to kill Mirren right away. For instance, we played a game last week, and I kept Mirren. I played it once.
I don't think anybody killed her.
Didn't die the entire game. I eventually died because you suspended 80 cards with Jorah, and that's what happens when you play against Jorah. And if we haven't mentioned, I'm bad at killing people. But yeah, no, it was definitely just people have stopped caring about her being alive. But something that I definitely learned early was you need to be able to use her the turn you play her.
Right.
The other thing I learned is, and you know, this is one of the cards you added, is anything that gives your cards instant speed. So I have Vilalken already in the deck because she can return creatures to your hand. Being able to then cast those for value during other people's turns is really high.
So Vilalken Orrery is a 4-drop artifact. You can find it from Conspiracy. I would pick these up now because they're starting to creep back up in price.
The card's great.
Yeah. In fact, this is one of those cards that I just find myself constantly adding to every deck.
It should be in every commander deck.
Yeah, I really think it's probably there. So Vilalken Orrery, 4-drop artifact. You may cast non-land cards as though they had flash.
I guess Teferi creature decks don't need it if that's your commander.
Right.
But then who are you and how evil are you?
At this point, any deck, any card that can help you get back to doing what Prophet of Kruphix helped you do, it's probably a pretty good
card,
right?
It's
right?
Half of Prophet of Kruphix.
Right.
But better, as in it's not even just creatures, it's not land cards.
Well, it can be better in the sense that it doesn't have to be in a specifically green-blue deck.
Yeah, like exactly.
Well, I'm just saying that's how good Prophet of Kruphix
was. Yeah, yeah.
Because this card is basically half of Prophet of Kruphix, and it's still a must-include in every commander deck.
And isn't Prophet of Kruphix the only banned gold card, or is there another one?
No, there's Coalition Victory.
Right.
There's, there's a couple.
Okay, cool. All right. Ignore me.
Coalition Victory. card.
But Vilalken Orrery, take a look at it. If it's not in your deck, you should have a very good reason why it's not. That could be price, but
card is ridiculous.
There's another thing. This deck generally leads you down a certain path, and I have avoided it. Mirren is really good at the, I'm forgetting what they're called, Grave Pact cards, where if I sacrifice a creature, Dictate Erebos.
Right.
And I have a Tezza deck, and it's very much on that game plan. And that's all about killing people with Pain Blood Artist and the new Blood Artist that just came out and sacrificing all my permanents. Yeah. And I never attack anyone in that deck. And eventually just kills them through sacrifice effects.
Mm-hmm.
And I avoided it because I don't want the exact same deck times 2. I don't need 2 of the exact commander deck.
Right.
But this deck, and something I'm not doing but other people should do, is play that strategy.
Fleshbag Marauder every turn
good.
Is very, very good.
Right.
Very
and good, yeah. Not to mention just like Evolutionary Leap is overpowered in this deck. And Evolutionary Leap with Mirren, with Grave Pact is just an insane board state that most people can't just beat.
Right.
Evolutionary Leap is one of the cards that a lot of people put on their list
for pet cards.
For
yeah.
pet cards, I noticed.
Thank you,
yeah.
by the way, everyone that submitted your pet cards. I had a blast reading through all of them.
I wrote a lot down. So the next time we do another like underrated cards or hidden gems or pet cards episode, I have a bag full of them. It's going to be awesome. Jimmy,
I think my favorite
them.
Pet card, by the way, was someone said Jace the Mind Sculptor.
It's not that great a commander. It draws a target on your face and it bounces a creature.
It's pretty
good. Still pretty good.
It's pretty awesome. Brainstorm every turn is good.
Yes, I agree with that.
Evolutionary Leap is one in a green for an enchantment. It says pay a green and sacrifice a creature. Reveal cards from the top of your library until you reveal a creature card. Put that card into your hand and the rest on the bottom of your library in any order. So it just draws you a creature card whenever you sack a creature, which you want to do with Marin anyway, and also just added value when stuff dies is good anyway.
You get a sacrifice trigger on a stick, so you get to really start firing off her experience counter count. And mm-hmm. on top of that, you put those creatures into your graveyard that you will then get back. So you're really not sacrificing a creature. You're just getting a sacrifice trigger because Marin does what she does. And you're drawing creature cards to then also use with Marin because they're probably good with her. And it's a chain that eventually makes you very happy. The most favorite thing I've done with it is Golgari Thug is one of the dredgers in the deck. And dredgers are important because you need to fill your card up with graveyard.
Right.
But Evolutionary Leap and Golgari Thug, the way the triggers work together, because Golgari Thug, when it dies, lets you put a creature card from your graveyard on top of your library, lets you literally return any card from your graveyard to your hand whenever you need it.
Right, because that draw... Yeah. So the Evolutionary Leap trigger...
So Evolutionary Leap, you sack a creature to draw. Then the trigger of Golgari Thug dying lets you put a creature card on top of your library, which then Evolutionary Leap lets you draw.
That's a very good combination. Golgari Thug, 1 in the black for a 1/1 human warrior. When Golgari Thug dies, put target creature card from your graveyard on top of your library and dredge 4. If you would draw a card, you can instead put exactly 4 cards from the top of your library into your graveyard. If you do return this card from your graveyard to your hand. So it
lets you loop the dredges. Like, it lets you get that dredge trigger every turn.
So Golgari Thug with Evolutionary Leap means you get to regrow whatever card you want to when the thug dies.
Right, and you're fueling your dredge engine because during your draw step, you'll dredge Golgari Thug to continue the chain and put 4 more cards in your graveyard, and that's like drawing 4 cards a turn instead of 1. Plus, right.
It's kind of like brainstorming every turn.
Yeah.
Because actually better because you're looking at 4 more cards every turn, basically. Right. Yeah.
Let's talk about dredge for just a hot second here. It's a mechanic that we very rarely talk about on the show, but it is one that is pretty high in the storm scale, correct?
No, it'll never. It's like storm banding is higher than storm. Dredges are right below storm.
That's
right.
Only because banding is confusing,
right? Yeah. Well, no one knows how that mechanic works.
The storm scale, by the way, is Mark Rosewater's scale that essentially says these are the mechanics that very very likely will not see reprint the closer it is to storm.
It's right.
Basically, like them saying
standard
these are
reprint.
The
right.
Yeah.
Standard,
yeah.
These
yeah.
are like the ones where they said these were kind of mistakes.
Yeah. No. They're overpowered or too powerful in what they do. Because dredge, as we just said. If you build your deck around Graveyard Shenanigans, reads you draw 4 cards instead of drawing
right.
a card.
Right.
So dredge is just the mechanic where instead of drawing a card, you basically mill yourself for a certain
for whatever
amount.
The number yeah. is. Yeah.
And a lot of times in dredge decks, and maybe you do this in this deck, on your very first turn, you'll just purposely not play a land so you can discard a dredge card and just start that.
Right. And well,
from turn
are,
one.
There are yeah. blatant. Very powerful Legacy and Vintage decks. Yeah. That's literally the game plan.
Yep.
They're like it's the only deck in Magic that will draw first every single time if it can.
Yeah.
Probably the most famous dredge card, especially for Commander players, is Life from the Loam.
Yep.
Which is another one of my pet cards, I would say, and is maybe the second most tutored card in the deck. I think I've entombed for Life from the Loam more than any card I've ever entombed for.
Life from the Loam, one in the green.
So good, by the way.
For a sorcery, return up to 3 target land cards from your graveyard to your hand, and you can dredge 3. So you essentially can just draw plenty of lands
right.
with Life from the Loam.
A lot of green-black decks have a problem if they get choked up on lands. Mm-hmm. That's an issue. And this lets you get the lands you need, lets you dredge. And that's the problem with dredging, is you never draw cards. And when you're not drawing cards, you're not drawing lands, so that means your mana base isn't growing. But what Life from the Loam lets you do is make sure you get those mana bases and getting you the dredge. So it does everything you kind of want to do in one nice little cute package. Plus, you can strip mine, which is really mean.
Life from the Loam is just very, very good.
Yeah, very good indeed. Especially when you're just popping up strip mines left and right there. Oof. Rough.
Oh, man, I loved it didn't come together, but in the very first Masters of Modern, that there was like, what is it, Worm Harvest? and Life from the Loam, there was that deck. There was a black green deck.
Modern Masters.
Yeah,
Modern
the Masters very one, first. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, not your podcast.
The very first episode, we brewed a land destruction deck because that's how we figured we're going to get followers.
In Modern Masters 1, that was one of the draft archetypes. It didn't always come together, but when it did, you just streamrolled everybody.
Oh, no, my GP Vegas, the first one, my deck was the coolest thing on the planet. I had Life from the Loam. I had all the dredge pieces, but I had Academy Ruins. I had all the Mana that do five colors. I had Knight of the Reliquary. I would dredge into a like 20/20 Knight of the Reliquary.
That's awesome.
And then like get the lands back when I needed them. It was the most fun I've ever had. I like cycled the Etch Champion with Academy Ruins like 30 times one game. I just like literally drew through my whole deck, and I had started playing with sideboarded games of like 10 extra cards because I would deck myself before killing my opponent.
Jeez, that is intense. So now that we've talked about sort of how you've envisioned the deck, how you wanted to see it play, and some of the things you've already done, like we've notably said, you've taken out cards that are higher than six drops because both with the Vancouver Mulligan and also just the deck doesn't necessarily want it. Also, how often are you going to get Marin up to 7, 8, 9?
It happens. That's something that's really interesting. That's what's weird about experience counters. It's going to happen no matter what.
Right.
Eventually, I'm going to get the counters I need because at worst case scenario, I play her when I have a bunch of creatures in play late game, and it just will happen.
Or somebody can just Supreme Verdict, and then it'll happen.
Yeah, it'll happen. Yeah. So that's one of the insane things, and I'm not even sure I like it about experience counters. It's maybe a complaint I have, is that they're just so inevitable. And with some of them, it's in, like, Mizzix decks. Like, it feels so inevitable that eventually they're just going to have infinite mana for all intents and purposes.
Yeah. I think Mizzix is actually harder to get experience counters on, depending. I think a deck like this or the one that gets it for just creatures coming to the battlefield with power 2 or less can be way easier because you can get them a lot at one time.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think Marin is the easiest. I think Mizzix has the most explosive use of them because eventually...
Absolutely. Yes. Marin, if you get to 10 experience counters, it doesn't matter past mattering. That.
I literally... Yeah. Like, I'm planning on... I'm trying to get as many of the experience tokens they give you to make one of those Abacus 3D... experience counters for this deck, and I'm not going to put more than 10 because there's no creature in my deck more than 10 experience. Right. If that happens, I'm just like, I would.
Then you're just like, anything I want, I get out. Yeah.
Pretty much anything you want. Sneezes out, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Except for like,
bless you,
Ulamog or something like that.
But no, but they shuffle back. You can't even play them.
Oh, that's
Ulamog
a really good
you can do, I guess.
Ulamog you could, yeah. So
that's like the largest thing I could be like, really trying to pull off. But then you don't get the cast trigger either. So it's just, you're getting a 10/10 indestructible.
That mills.
Give me Terracidon.
Yeah, it's true.
All the time.
What about like what's the Void Winnower or something? That's just gonna make people mad.
Well, I mean, he can't even.
He doesn't do anything when it comes to anything.
That joke's never.
All right. So speaking of adding and subtracting cards, are there any cards right now that are on the chopping block, and why? And what are you looking to put in there?
Yes. So I would say I have 5 cards I'm currently considering chopping.
One of my favorite cards is at the top.
Brutalizer Exarch, which I literally just added when I searched for 6 or more drops while going through it. I don't think he does enough.
The card is very good, however. It's 5 and a green for a creature cleric 3/3. When it enters the battlefield, you can either search your library for a creature card, reveal it, and then put that card on top of your library after you shuffle your library, or you can put target non-creature permanent on the bottom of its owner's library. So it can tuck a non-creature permanent, essentially, on the bottom.
And I think he's really good. I think he's worse in this deck now because of what we talked about. I put a lot of work in getting a lot of artifact hate in there and a lot of tutor cards in the early drop slots. So now that that exists, there are better large drops that I am playing that can kill permanents. Mm-hmm. And the tutor effect isn't nearly as important because by the time I get the 6 mana, I should have dredged 30 cards and tutored for the exact
You'll
things
have
I
found
need.
The
and I don't need it anymore. So that's number one. Number two, Nim's Death Mantle.
Another good card. Yeah. Also another pet card that I saw a couple times.
I think this is way better in white decks. Or actually more specifically blue decks. Because of the fact that you keep mana open.
Right. So Nim Deathmantle says it's a 2-drop equipment. Equipped creature gets +2/+2, has intimidate, and is a black zombie. So creatures with intimidate can't be blocked except for artifact creatures and or creatures that share a color with it. And whenever a non-token creature is put into your graveyard from the battlefield, something that Marin does, you may pay 4 colorless mana, or 4 generic mana, sorry. If you do, return that card to the battlefield and attach Nim Deathmantle to it.
So my issue with this is purely the fact that green-black doesn't like keeping its mana open. Mm-hmm. You're tapping out whenever you can, and keeping 4 mana up is really costly. And you have to kill something. I mean, yes, there are going to be times where you can do that yourself, but because of what Marin does, Marin almost does that better for you. And so it's a little redundant, and you don't have the mana to keep open for it.
That's a great point, because that is something I don't think comes through my head very often when thinking about adds and cuts. Like a card like Nim Deathmantle, you read it and it says, oh, this is perfect for Marin. We're already recurring stuff. This is redundancy. We talked about this. This is, you know, re-triggering Enter the Battlefield triggers. This seems like what you want to do, but the fact that you're not holding up mana and the fact that you're also just going to be dredging and doing stuff already where you're getting cards in your graveyard and you don't really care if they're already there.
Right, and the deck has a lot of death triggers versus ETB triggers, so you don't get as many accidental someone killing your creature and you getting it back. Mm-hmm. It's more like you're doing it yourself, and so there are definitely mana concerns, and that's my biggest problem with it, and I wouldn't have learned with it without having played with it 5x times and being like, oh, I wish this was just a creature that did something.
Yeah, that's something I find when I'm going through and evaluating the deck as I'm playing it, is just like, how does each card feel?
Mm-hmm. You know? Right.
So then when I go later, what I do is I'll just sort of look at each card and be like, how did this feel when I had it? And a lot of cards, they just feel like, I felt like I couldn't find a spot to play this card.
Yeah.
You know, and that's very common. And it's very common on cards like Nim Deathmantle, where you sort of have to delve into why. And what you found out was, oh, I couldn't find a spot to play it because I couldn't find a spot where I wanted to have four mana open.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not anything about the card exactly, it's actually the way that the card forces you to function. And that's something to really pay attention to. That was something like in Mizzix where I kept talking about, like, every time I played it, and when I started tweaking it the next time, I would just pull out anything that wasn't an instant or sorcery, because every time I held a card in my hand that wasn't an instant or sorcery, even Sol Ring, I kept thinking, I don't have a spot to play this because I want to hold my mana open. Nim Deathmantle, exact opposite. I don't have a spot to play this because I don't want to hold my mana
open.
Right. But it's just feel, really.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, there's two phases for me, and this is back to the subject of the podcast. There's when you first build it, there's just like the grandiose, obvious things you did wrong. And that's where I start making changes immediately, quickly, just to get through as many different ways of playing to see what works best. And then there's the, I've now played 100 games with this deck, and I've noticed that, oh, on game 98 through 99, I kept drawing Nim's Deathmantle and being like, oh, this does nothing. I need a better card for this. Or this card is clunky for whatever reasons it's clunky, and then you change it one by one.
Let me ask you guys something. Have you ever taken a card out of your deck and then at some point later been like, no, actually, I should have that card in the deck?
Mm-hmm.
All the time. I can't expressly tell you one right now, though.
Not
commander related. Oh, Jimmy, you do yours.
Grave Titan. The card is amazing.
It's bonkers.
It's bonkers. And then I took it out of Marchesa because I was like, you know, I don't need this big creature. It just makes 2/2s and whatever. And then I realized, no, this makes a lot.
No, it's a win condition.
It's a
win condition a lot of times in colors that don't always have them.
Yeah. The card gets out of control extremely quickly, and the fact that you can recur it with Marchesa once it gets some counters on it is also very, very...
Right. I put it in Teyza just because of the tokens, because it's a black token maker, and you play in Teyza every black token maker you can find that has good value, and it's like, you forget just, oh, when I cast this, I'm probably winning because I have 10 power in the field that's just going to grow and grow, and they can't do anything about it.
Demands so removal.
Next card on the list.
And well, Josh, do you have any cards you've done?
Oh, Vedalken Orrery is probably the one that I've done that with the most because it feels like, oh, I'm fine. I don't need to cast it. But when you have Vedalken Orrery on the table, you feel like that's the best that you can feel in Magic, which is like, I can do my stuff whenever I feel like it. And in multiplayer, it's so much more important because there's three other players or four other players, and I need to be able to, like, you know, respond. It gives virtual haste to my creatures. Like, it's so good. Yeah. But it always feels when you're... It's hard. Those are the type of cards that are really hard to evaluate when you're not playing.
Right.
So when you're just looking at a bunch of cards, Vedalken Orrery looks expendable. But when you're playing, you realize, man, every time I have that, I feel so good. Like, my deck just feels like it's really, really, I don't know.
It's just ready to respond in the best way.
Yeah, you feel safe.
Creatures with Enter the Battlefield abilities become instants, you know? And when you can make every card in your deck essentially adding new keywords to it, it's very powerful.
Having the ability to respond to what your opponents are doing. Just that. Being able to be like, oh, you did that thing. Now I know the exact correct decision that I should have made on my turn.
Right.
Because it's basically you're getting to see the future.
Hindsight is 20/20.
You're getting to move your seat too, which I think is so important in Commander, because if Alex is playing the counterspell deck, well, sitting directly to the left of him is the worst place I can be, because that's the point where he's going to have the most mana open and the most counterspells in his hand. Whereas if I'm sitting directly to his right, now he has to get through everything Jimmy casts, Craig casts, and he might counterspell some of their stuff, and then it's my turn, and he might not have a counterspell anymore or mana open. And so being able to move your seat virtually is just so powerful. So, yeah, I've talked enough about. I should have put that on my pet cards, although everybody plays it. So,
I guess before I move on to the next card I want to cut, I do want to mention with redundancy, because it's going to come up, I think, immediately anyways. There are redundancy effects that are good and bad. So Liliana Heretic's Healer, which is the creature one, is the type of redundancy in this deck that I think it wants. Because eventually you get to the point where you have enough mana or you have enough time to start bringing back multiple things. And so anything that lets you do that on your turn for free is very strong. And she has, you know, her trigger is very online with what you're doing already, which is sacrificing a creature.
Right. That's Liliana Heretic Healer from Origins. Right.
Yeah, if you recall, she flips over on our Planeswalker side if a creature you control died this turn.
Non-token, yeah.
And you get a token, and then she can reanimate spells, basically, or creatures.
Pretty powerful. I like that card quite a bit.
So next on the cut list, and this is going to be a little bit sinful for people because people expect this to be an all-green-black decks, is Gerard Golgari Lichlord. This has a really similar problem to Niv-Mizzet Deathmantle. Also, I don't like killing people. I think that might be an issue because it's like definitely a win condition.
This is certainly a win condition. And this is a deck that a lot of people... This is, by the way, in the Marin deck.
Yeah, it comes pre-con. With... Yeah.
So it's black, black, green, green for a 2-2 zombie elf legendary. Of course, Gerard Golgari Lichlord gets +1/+1 for each creature card in your graveyard. Already sounding pretty gravy. One, a black and a green. Sacrifice another creature. Each opponent loses life equal to the sacrificed creature's power. That's a win condition. And finally, sacrifice a swamp and a forest, and you can return Gerard from your graveyard to your hand. Why are you cutting this, Alex?
It's like on the bottom of the cut list. Like, I definitely see it sticking around longer, but it's so mana hungry. And
right.
The fact that he's big never matters. You're not attacking anyone with him because it's commander, and attacking with a single creature that doesn't have evasion doesn't really get in.
Or that isn't your commander.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, if that's happening and you're getting in, you're picking on the one guy that you like don't want to be attacking because they have nothing. And that might be me being nice.
Well, it also leaves you open.
Yeah. There's a lot of things that are problematic with it. It's definitely on the lower end because it is a win condition that late game can help you kill stuff, but it is super mana hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And to be totally honest, he's probably the biggest creature. This deck isn't running, because of the curve problem, isn't running a lot of big things to throw at people. It's not like other reanimator decks where you're trying to get big. If I was playing with him, I'd have a bunch of 7-drops. But because I am playing with Mirren and I have a bunch of 1 and 2-drops, throwing a Spore Frog at someone isn't exactly super exciting.
Yeah,
not to mention, you don't want to sack that Spore Frog anyway.
Yeah, that's what I think makes the most sense, is if you're going to make the decision to take out the larger drops for a variety of reasons we already discussed, then Gerard just gets a lot worse.
Right, and it's power. If it was converted mana cost, I'd almost be more interested.
Right.
But like most of the big creatures I'm keeping, other than maybe Terracidon, are like really 3/3s. Like even Brutalizer Exarch is a 3/3.
Right. And it's very hard for you to chain Gerard in the way that really makes him broken, where you're getting the creatures back. You just get one a turn.
Right. And
on your turn.
If you look at the Avenger of Zendikar, like that's a slightly bigger creature. That's one of the higher drops. But even that one, I'm winning in anyways.
I don't actually want to sacrifice it. Yeah, that's the win condition.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. So like it ends up being like, A, I'm either using big mana to play this creature or he's not doing enough. Next is Corpse Augur. This is another redundancy one. For those who don't know, Corpse Augur is 3 and a black. He is a creature zombie wizard. When Corpse Augur dies, you draw X cards and lose X life, where X is the number of creature cards in target player's graveyard, and he is a 4/2.
So card draw.
Really good.
Very powerful. Yeah, especially because you're usually targeting yourself, I'm guessing.
True.
Because you've dredged like 20 creatures into there.
Well, then you lose 20 life.
True. You draw 20 cards.
My issue with it is redundancy.
Uh-huh.
There is an issue of life loss. Like, eventually, you don't want to target yourself because you're going to be killing yourself, possibly.
Right.
But more in reality, this deck doesn't need card advantage as much as other decks because it inherently is a card advantage engine. The whole deck does that.
Right.
Versus other black decks that I can imagine wanting this, where you want to be drawing a lot of cards. Like, if I was doing a black-red deck or a black-white deck, having a card draw engine like this would be super powerful. But in this deck specifically, I'm dredging 4 cards a turn, which is I'm literally brainstorming 4 cards a turn. Every time I mill my deck, that's drawing those cards. Mirren lets me draw cards. I'm rebuying creatures. That amount of card advantage is decent. But by the time it's good, you have cards already, and it takes a while to get there already.
Yeah, there's a point at which card draw is actually not helping you anymore. You know, if you draw one more card than everybody else, that's helping you a lot because you're doubling the amount of cards your opponents are having. If you're drawing 7 more cards than everybody else, that's helping you a lot. But the 8th card doesn't help you as much.
Right.
Because that's just percentage wise. Like, oh, I got another like 9% advantage now. And then the next card is even less. Yeah, so I can see, and we always advocate a lot of card draw on mana ramp because those things smooth out your deck, but there is definitely diminishing returns on that stuff.
Well, and early game card draw is really good in this deck even, but right. This isn't an early game card draw because someone has to have creatures in their graveyard.
Yeah, that's right. A really good point. You can't really just do it on turn five because you might only have two creatures in there. And
at
like,
best,
it's okay.
You have one and it's okay, yeah. And then you put all the effort of making that happen. The other thing with it is this, and I mentioned it before, this is a tap out deck. I don't hold mana open. Mm-hmm. So drawing a bunch of cards doesn't do that much for me because options don't matter as much because I'm the active player. I'm not waiting to see what you do and seeing, oh, which one of my 12 answers in my hand do I have to stop you? I'm putting things in play and hoping that I can either overthink what you're going to do or just do my own thing and hope you don't stop me.
Right. Not to mention, Corpse Augur is in this weird spot with this deck in particular where he's at his best when you're drawing like 5 to 10 cards, and he quickly actually becomes worse because you start losing a lot of life. Being forced to target someone else's graveyard is never ideal because you can't really control what's going on there. So it is an interesting cut. I think I agree here. You've got so many other things going on where you're getting things to your hand, you're returning them to the battlefield, that just straight card draw isn't necessarily what you want to do unless you're trying to draw so much that you're forced to discard.
Right. And last but not least, in Tumor Exarch, he is one of the Exarchs, so he has two abilities you get to choose. One is return target creature card from your graveyard to your hand. The other one is target opponent reveals his or her hand, and you choose a non-creature card from it, and then that player discards that card. He is a cleric, he is a 2/2, and he costs 2 and 2 black. To be totally honest, it's just not a good commander card. He's very good and constructed with Birthing Pod-like decks. This deck is a Birthing Pod-like deck. It's playing Birthing Pod.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, because it only affects one player, isn't that great. And when the Gravedigger effect is better on like three other cards in the deck, including and especially Marin.
Yeah, it feels like a tool that you don't actually need.
Right.
Yeah.
And like,
because one
targeted
card,
discard doesn't do anything to anyone.
Yeah. It's just too hard for it to basically whiff. I mean, you'll get something, but it's so hard to know like which player should I point it at. And then
it could just not matter. If I target you, Jimmy could be the one with the counterspell.
Yeah, exactly.
Or if I target Jimmy, you're right. The one that has a Genesis wave and just win the next turn. I'm like, oh, well, that was a waste of everything.
Yeah, it's just too hard to aim it correctly. It's right. Too hard to hit the bullseye with that card.
It's the same reason Burn is bad in Commander. Because pointing beyond life totals, but like any targeted thing is bad against one player.
Yeah.
If I'm like
it's
three damage to damage is just. Yeah, that's definitively like discarding three cards at that point.
Definitely. Very interesting. Well, I loved seeing those, especially because none of those cards were inherently bad just by looking at it, right? Each of those needed a justification. Each of those could easily have made the cut in the deck, but I loved the reasoning behind it. I think it's a really important lesson to learn that sometimes you do have to get rid of the cards that you think are doing what you want the deck to do, and it follows sort of the quote-unquote guidelines that we've set forth on the show of redundancy and making sure your deck can function without your commander. But you also have to consider what the card is doing sort of in the overall span of the game. And that's something you actually brought up that we could talk about a lot more in the future is what is your role in the commander game at the table? Are you control? Are you beat down? Are you the aggressor?
Right.
Are you sitting back? Are you holding mana open? And that actually helped answer a lot of questions about which cards were going to stay and which ones are going to go.
And what the role of the deck is. I would also say, you know, something to always consider with the deck is there's a real cost in Commander of including and all constructed magic. But because Commander is no matter what 99 cards to a certain extent, even though all their formats are pretty much that anyways. But this is costing another card. This Corpse Augur could be a answer to a, like, I don't have a good graveyard effect, hate effect maybe in here. And then I'm just going to get steamrolled by graveyard hate dose. The other guy at the table who's maybe more efficient than me or is doing one of the more hyper-aggressive graveyard
just
strategies.
Just got off to a better start.
And because I'm playing some weird dirtily, I draw a bunch of cards that I don't need, I don't get to have that answer I need to that. Or I don't have X, Y, Z that I need to do my plan.
Right.
One of the really interesting things that you said about Corpse Augur, which is the card draw that I really like, is just thinking of how your deck plays and therefore how that card plays. So what you said about how card advantage doesn't matter as much because my deck already has it in another way, but also just the way that I'm playing my deck. So this deck's going to tap out and play all its stuff.
Right.
And so it's not playing like, because a lot of people will see that deck with Consecrated Sphinx and they draw 40 cards and they just say draw go and just sit there and like answer everything that happens. And they'll be like, oh, I want to play my deck like that. But you can't play You couldn't play the Marin deck that way because that's not the way that the deck can work, right? You have to play your creatures out, and then they have to hit the table and do stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do think Marin, you can build a deck that way with Marin, even with Marin, because I do think there are cool ways to take a commander in ways people don't think about.
Right,
and with
Marin,
if you just play only the black and green cards that have flash or are instant speed effects, or you give them instant speed somehow, or you're only playing with spells and creatures that kind of do that, then you can build your deck to be, I have my mana open all the time.
Right.
Because her other ability is you don't have to put it into play, or you do if it's below the mana cost. You can just always draw it, and at that point, you can play that Drago-style commander play with her. I'd love to see a deck like that. I personally didn't build it.
it would be difficult. I agree you can't. I guess what I'm saying is just realizing, like, oh, that's good for that deck for these reasons. That doesn't mean it's good for my deck for the same reason.
Well, and that's, I guess, more of the point, and this is the point you're making, is look at what your deck's trying to do, not what could it do, but what are you trying to do with your deck, and then make sure your deck is following suit with that. Consecrated Sphinx is great when you are countering everything, because your opponents are now afraid, because you literally have every card
that
you could ever want.
Ever.
That's not as good when you're tapped out. It just isn't, because people don't, like, I can have all the cards in the world, but if I don't have any mana, I'm not doing anything with them unless they're all Force of Will, and that's a
then you're cheating.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, did you see the it's a story, but basically they created a format where there was no ban list, no card in Magic is banned, and they all have to create a deck, and they all show up to the table, and you know, people are playing Moxes and Black Lotuses and blah 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 blah, and one guy's just sitting there, and like, okay, it's your turn. He's not doing anything. He's just putting lands and creatures in the play, but not really anything. And they're like, okay, we don't get it. And they're all like bad early cards, and then they all like turn away for a second, and he takes the proxies out of every deck, and they're all cheaty face.
My favorite card. Oh my goodness, I should have put that under my pet cards. That is fantastic. Well, that's one way to do it.
Cheaty face.
So build your deck right, guys.
That's just right.
Proxies and cheaty face.
All right, let's move on to the listeners. So Kessler has a very special question for you guys that actually you get asked all the time, correct?
Me? Yeah. Yeah. And we ask our listeners. So the question is, which commander card that isn't legal in Modern would you like to see be played in Modern?
Marin, or
legal
of Clan Nel'Toth. Can I say Marin?
Yeah, you can say Marin. Yeah. I would love the red Planeswalker commander.
Oh, Duretti.
Duretti would be my favorite.
Goodness.
That'd be so sick.
That would be unbelievable.
I don't think it should be, maybe, but like, it's super sick. Well, it's a 4-drop. I guess Infect would kill that person pretty quick. He's sweet. I love that guy.
Yeah, Duretti's very powerful.
Maybe one day next time, or one of the times I'll be on, we can talk about my Malfagor deck that has, it's all artifact themed, and it's like a black-red Duretti deck, basically. But because Malfagor lets you discard your hand, it's just a discard outlet.
I played against that deck. You don't,
I don't kill people very quickly.
But I've actually
my win percentage with the deck is crazy
high.
Oh,
the deck's
very good. Yeah, very good. Yeah, Sire of Insanity status.
Most people end up not having any cards in their hands either. Because
Sire of Insanity. Yeah, that card's really good. That's the problem. Sometimes colors just have a specific. If you're black red, why aren't you playing Sire of Insanity? Because you're a nice person, I guess. But like, from a power level perspective, you're not playing correctly.
Indeed.
All right, time for the end step, where we talk about something cool outside the world of Magic. Kessler, you told us you had something cool.
So I started, and it's a long path, but it's listening to the book, The Name of the Wind.
In the Name of the Wind.
The Name of the Wind, which is a King Killer Chronicles book. One of the first
King
two
Filler.
Of many.
I believe.
So the path to reading this book, I actually have owned it in every version. I own a hard copy, I own a Kindle version, and then I bought the audiobook version with my Audible account, because I have a friend who literally said, he moved to Prague, and he said, I am not going to talk to you on Facebook until you finish this book.
Six months ago.
And I'm just like, I can't, whatever reason, that first chapter, just, I kept rereading it. I've heard the thing where one character gets robbed like 50 times in the first chapter, and like, finally, book on tape, got on an airplane to Hong Kong, and was like, I'm getting through this. And so I'm now into it. And
it is King Killer. I said King Filler for some reason.
Oh, because I made that joke earlier.
King Filler makes no sense. King Killer, a lot more sense.
Yeah, there's two, actually. I've read them both. The second one's like the the slow regard of silent things, the silent regard of slow things, the something regard of something things.
What's interesting about it, I'm
the wise man's fear, right?
Letting all my nerd flag fly.
There's a third one, but it's like a mini, it's a novella, I think is what it is. And that's the regard of things. Yeah, you're right. It's, yeah, okay, fine. I got the names wrong. Anyway, so Patrick Rothfuss. Rothfuss.
I'm going to let my nerd flag fly a little bit, or show a little bit, but I've watched
magic
an anime
podcasts
before in my life, and one of them I watched recently because Netflix did their own exclusive was the Seven Deadly Sins one, which was decent. It was pseudo cheesy, but whatever. I was bored one night and finished all 12 episodes or whatever it was. But they're like identical, except one's a cheesy anime with anime tropes. But like, it starts with weird barkeep that's like has a mysterious past where he's actually like a crazy badass that everyone's afraid of, and he's like wanted by the government, but no one knows who he is. And then someone shows up and like tells everyone what's going on. And then he used to hang out with a team of people that like, and then there's these guys, and I'm only at the part where the bad guys show up, I guess, but they're also very similar.
But that's just, I mean, that's
the trope 101.
I mean, that's just like old samurai or Western too. Like, true. Yeah, it's just sort of,
it's kind of like what that Star Wars movie did with that Star Wars movie.
The hero's tale. Well, except like this is a slightly different trope where that's like farm boy that's becoming a hero, and those are bartender that was a hero and telling you his tale.
Well, it's
just one, he was a farm boy.
I was talking Force Awakens versus Episode 4 in terms of similar stories.
Oh,
but
we don't
need to get into that. Not now.
I'll defend it for days.
I know you will. And the name of the book is In the Name of the Wind, Patrick Rothfuss. By the way, look at the picture of this guy. His beard is epic. Holy,
you know,
you
would never
boy
be allowed on a magic card because they don't like wizards with pointy hats and big beards.
Really?
Yeah, that's
because
they
don't want it to be cliche.
Yeah, they're against the cliches.
I want people to look at Patrick Rothfuss, Robert Jordan, the late great, and George R. R. Martin, and there's just evidently like a certain kind of look that a fantasy writer has to have.
What book series did Robert Jordan
Wheel
write?
Of Time.
Oh,
don't
do another
do
podcast.
Do not start that series.
Yeah,
because it is like 50,000 pages of. It's so long.
Oh, holy, I mean, holy. Getting into things. So I went to a Cracked podcast screening, the Cracked podcast, for my birthday, which was yesterday. My girlfriend bought me tickets and it was okay. But one of the guys, when they opened up the question, came up and was like, just started going for like 10 minutes on a rant about Wheel of Time. And I was like, oh no, kid, please stop. This is going to be on the internet.
Don't do it, kid.
Don't do it.
It was about Oscars and racism. And he went about the Wheel of Time for 30 minutes. I was like, this is rough.
That is intense.
Well, on that note,
never bring up Wheel of Time on a podcast.
No.
Yeah.
We're breaking the rule to teach the rule.
They got their money's worth out of the end step this time, I guess. Five things that we talked about.
I consume a lot of content. It was my birthday. Did I tell you my birthday?
Oh yeah, end step. Alex Kessler's birthday.
If you guys are in LA and want to go to Dave and Buster's this Saturday before this podcast was released,
if you have a time machine,
yeah,
you
make
be
it
watching
back
the
in
Pro Tour. Can you tell us? Just tweet at me who won and how right or wrong I was.
Absolutely.
About what?
Considering it ends on Sunday,
I'm gonna say Swedish Kibler won.
Swedish Kibler?
Yeah.
Oh,
Yol, your buddy Yol.
Yol. I love Yol, man. Team Eureka, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they had a great run at the last GP they all played at, so I'm a big fan of
He's
Yol.
He's pretty
obviously
good at Magic.
I've heard tale.
And he took a mono red deck all the way home, and he also played an EDH game and won it on stream. I mean, the guy is lights out my hero right now. You know what I mean?
Jimmy has like stars in his eyes right now. Yeah. Well,
I'm
he's pretty dreamy.
He's very dreamy.
Oh, also, tweet at whoever won if it wasn't Yol Larson or if it was Yol Larson, and tell them to be on the Masters of Modern podcast so I can get them on there.
You realize this is going to come out after the Modern Pro Tour's already happened.
Yeah,
and
but
after
we're just going to keep. I wanted the whole top eight. We're going to do a run. We're
going
to try.
We're going all the way.
Speaking of which, if you want to hear the Yol Larson interview, make sure to check out the Masters of Modern podcast.
He's kind of obligated now.
Yeah, he has to. He is Eldrazi obligated.
Next Tuesday.
To go on his
show. I mean, we know a guy that knows him. Maybe you could.
Yeah,
you know,
next Tuesday, Yol Larson.
Account. What can you pay me?
If he's not there, I'll pay me.
Wait, you know him?
Will you pay me in buzzing pods?
Yeah.
I will take all your buzzing pods.
They're banned.
Not in EDH.
That's true. It's in my Marin deck, right? Right about there. No, I hoped I would pull the deck apart and it would be magically the card. It wasn't.
It's somewhere.
Actually, it was. You guys don't know because you're not here.
That's true.
So just did that.
Wow, we are so off the rails. I don't even know what happened. Kessler, what's your Twitter account?
You can find me at Kess Wiley, KESSWYLIE. I'm almost at 666 Twitter followers, guys. And then
you're the devil?
I could be the devil.
Let's
so
take
let's
it past.
Make that happen.
Let's make it 667. All right. All
well,
right.
If, I mean, yeah.
Tell us about your
more
podcast. Where can we find your podcast?
The podcast is at the MMCast. We are the sister podcast to you guys. We're on rocketjump.com. Also, literally, if you just click that podcast link right above, it'll bring you right to my podcast.
There
where
it
me
is.
And Ben talk about sweet modern stuff, brews, top 10 lists. We're going to be doing a run of having every top 8 competitor in the Modern Pro Tour that speaks English. Hopefully.
Nice. You should get a couple that don't as well.
We were debating it. We actually, so we had this guy who does MTG Tutor, which is another podcast that interviews pros. And he was talking about how he got someone that doesn't speak English on once. And he had a translator literally on the podcast.
Wow.
And I was like, maybe you can edit it so you have that translator and that person like over each other. Like they
you
do on the
could.
National
That's,
Geographic
yeah,
channel.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah. So maybe if someone wants to be, if someone knows a pro that top eights and is a translator, let's make it happen.
Wait, do you want the pro to be the translator?
No, I want the listener.
Oh, you want the listener to be a translator
and then be friends
the
with
pro.
The pro. Yeah.
Wow. That's synergy.
That
right
is
there.
Synergy. All right. Our editor for the show is Terry Robertson. And special thanks, of course, to Jeffrey Palmer for the living card animations. We have full videos for every single episode. Thanks to Terry's great work. You can check out Jeffrey Palmer's animations at Living Cards MTG. And you can also watch our video podcast at youtube.com/The Command Zone Podcast. Not to mention we have Kitchen Table Fables, a web series, live action Magic the Gathering. It's a lot of fun. And it's funny. It features the professor from Tulare Community College. And that's about it.
Oh, have you guys been watching his like Planeswalker cosplay series?
They're amazing.
Because they're really good.
Office hours.
Like I'm going to make a Dak Faden cosplay for GPLA.
You would be great for that.
And I'm going to because he's the only one I look like. But
because
he looks like Aladdin, and I look like Aladdin.
You
it's
can
really
do whatever you can
synergy.
Do whatever you want. It's Magic the Gathering.
Well, I don't want to find sideburns to pull Gideon off. Also, armor is
did
hard.
Gideon.
I
armor
have like
tough.
I'm just gonna repurpose my Star Lord trench coat. For Dax trench coat.
Look
it's
forward
easy.
To that at right, GPLA. Let's see you guys there.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Bye, guys.
Bye. See you next time.
Peace.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com. Or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.